It's still June 22nd, and we were talking, well, 1951, you were talking about expenditures, I think.
Well, this was during the time I was the DAQ at Kingston, and I was there from 51 to 54. Mm-hmm. And I gained a lot of experience there, being on the staff of the area headquarters staff. I was involved in inspection of all militia units as well as regular force units in the Eastern Ontario area. Mm-hmm. And Eastern Ontario stretched from Cornwall in the east up to Ottawa, up to Renfrew, and almost due south down to and including Port Hope.
Mm-hmm. And how large are the forces that were encompassed in this district, both militia and regular?
I couldn't say how large, except we had the Signal School in Vimy, mm-hmm. the Remy School in Barryfield, and we had militia units in Ottawa and in Cornwall and everywhere. Mm-hmm. The Hasty Peas, however, had their headquarters isn't that awful?
Belleville.
And they had companies at various villages or towns around there. They had the headquarters and one company in Belleville. Rather amusing thing. During that period, 51-54, the Q branch in Ottawa decided that there were a lot of stores out in militia units which were really not needed by the militia units, mm-hmm. and that these should be all called in. And it was up to the DAQ in the Eastern Ontario area with some staff to go and inspect the stores and the various militia units and get the stuff out. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't too bad with militia units in Ottawa because they were right close to the ordnance stores there, and the ordnance people did it themselves. Mm-hmm. But when it came to the Hasty Peas, I was asked to look into their store operation, and somebody had tipped them off, because when I arrived down in Belleville, lo and behold, when I went to the quarter stores, it was the tidiest and the smallest amount of stuff in the stores that I'd ever seen. And everybody was so nice to me. Mm-hmm. I had at least 3 free drinks in the mess. And I was suspicious because I'd known what the stores were like before. Mm-hmm. So when I left the headquarters in Belleville, I said to my driver, "We're going to head straight north from here." I can't remember at the moment the name of the town, but it was the most northern outpost of the Hasty Peas. And we traveled up there, having started off as if we were going back to Kingston, and then made a swing around and headed due north, and we arrived up there, and it was only sort of a sixth sense that told me to go there. Mm-hmm. I arrived there, and I went to the company commander's house. He happened to be there, and I got the key for the armory and went in, and you should have seen the stuff. Everything that they knew was surplus. They had shunted up to this northern point where they figured nobody would come.
Well, what kind of stuff did they have?
Oh, they had boots way beyond their entitlement. Mm-hmm. They, webbing, they had everything. Everything was in excess to their entitlement.
And it was all top flight equipment that could have been used by regular
forces. Oh, it could be used. And, I mean, if they had a larger number of people in the unit, they could have used it for equipping them. Mm-hmm. But based on their strengths at the time,
they didn't need it.
They didn't need it. But, of course, having got a good quartermaster, he said, "I've got to be prepared." And he was a good wartime quartermaster who knew how to scrounge extra things. And he had built up a terrific stock. But it was way beyond their entitlement.
So you requisitioned all this?
So I found this out, and I said, "All right, there are going to be trucks coming up here." Mm-hmm. And the truckloads of equipment over and above unit entitlement that went back into the 26th Ordnance Depot in Ottawa was just incredible. Mm-hmm. Truckload upon truckload. And the militia units were really brought down to entitlement, which is bare bones. Yeah. But I guess it had to be done.
Mm-hmm. Let's go off track again for a moment. 1951, the Korean War had started. Was there any thought given to you, or at least did you give any thought to perhaps volunteering?
Oh, I volunteered.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Were there
I volunteered for Korea.
Were you considered?
But what they were doing, what the Canadian defense establishment decided, was that they would recruit mm-hmm. people, preferably who were already ex-army,
mm-hmm.
Recruit them back into. Because though we had some good staff officers, the question of people with fighting experience who would come and take over command of a new unit and so forth was the people who could do that who were serving the regular army. They were either had been promoted and were brigadiers and not lieutenant colonels or something like that, and the people who were lieutenant colonels were perhaps getting a little bit long in the tooth, like I was,
mm-hmm.
believe it or not. And anyway, they decided to recruit if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so you found men like Jim Stone, who'd been out,
mm-hmm.
who came back in again and took over command of the, I think it was the 3rd Battalion, Patricia's, who went to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so you found a lot of people. In fact, when they sent the brigade over to Germany, they recruited, because what we had we needed, so to speak, internally,
mm-hmm.
and to take on this new, what was then a new NATO equipment commitment, they recruited. And you found that in one battalion there was a company of Seaforths
mm-hmm.
and a company of some other unit, like Canadian Scottish, and they were recruited here and then formed into a battalion, and only subsequently did they change, so you didn't have different type uniforms being worn in the one battalion.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me now, I know the Americans had trouble, or some degree of trouble, at least in Korea, with drafting of veterans of the Second World War. They called them retreads, I think, and oftentimes they couldn't handle it being in combat again as well. Was there any evidence of this in Canada?
No evidence. No evidence of that at all.
I know the Canadian Brigade, I think, distinguished itself quite well.
Oh, yes.
The Strathconas, or Strathconas?
Yeah, the Strathconas and the Patricias.
Yeah.
The Canadians. In fact, I've spoken to Jim Stone off and on over the years, and I remember him saying he just dreaded having American troops on his flank.
Mm-hmm.
Because he never knew how long they'd stay there. And he said they had a horrible habit of firing off all their small ammunition at distances where they couldn't hit a barn. And when the Chinese came in closer, they didn't have any ammunition left, so they bugged out.
So that's the fault of the officers, not really the men?
No, it's the fault of the training.
Mm-hmm. But indirectly, isn't that the fault of the officers?
No, the officers,
they're there in
the officers were doing the way they'd been trained. And you'll even find it in the good old American films. You find troops opening fire when the people they're firing at are at least quarter of a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
And there are damn few men with an ordinary rifle who can shoot a moving target at 400 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Canadian troops literally waited till the enemy got within 100 yards.
And they were still using Lee Enfield at the time as well.
And they could fire them rapidly.
Yeah.
And that was really telling, because every bullet just about counts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a heck of a big difference. And, of course, the Americans had semi-automatic
mm-hmm.
and automatic, and they loved to just... And they weren't hitting anything. It sounded good, but it wasn't achieving anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically the reason for their bug-outs.
They ran out of ammunition.
Which left us, you know, many of our fellows were at times in a ticklish situation,
mm-hmm.
finding themselves almost surrounded by the Chinese.
Yeah. Were you disappointed that you didn't get to, you weren't sent to
Korea? Yes.
Did you want it?
But I realized I'd have to be on staff. Well,
there's no chance
I have to admit that I rather enjoyed.
That.
No, I was told to my face that I was too old to take over command of an infantry battalion.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to resign myself.
And a staff commitment?
I was a staff officer. That was it.
Okay, so you're in Ontario, and how long were you there?
I was there until August of 54, when I got posted down to the Armed Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And that course was designed for officers of the United States Army, Air Force, and Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And
one Canadian,
the rank, the most junior rank, is a full colonel. Mm-hmm. Quite a few brigadiers, American.
And you were lieutenant colonel at this time? Or
I was a major.
Still major.
Still major. And there was one other Canadian officer on the course. He was from the Canadian Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And strange to say, his name was Norman. Mine, and his wife was Catherine, and so was mine. But we'd never seen each other before, but we got along very well. And my family joined me down there in September, and we rented a house in Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time since I had got married, I invested in a car.
Really, what kind did you buy?
I got a 49 Ford. Down in Norfolk, and it cost me $720.
Ye God.
And so it was 5 years old when I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to commute from our rented house right on the beach at Virginia Beach, which was just beautiful. And I used to drive into Norfolk to go to my classes and so forth.
Were these classes held up as they had been at Leavenworth?
No, they were on the British system. Small syndicates of about 25.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much better. And I gave a very interesting talk to my syndicate on Canada, which opened their eyes about Canada, because most of them didn't know where Toronto was. And as far as places like Calgary or Edmonton or Prince Albert, forget it. And Vancouver, well, that's somewhere on the West Coast, but isn't that one Washington State? And their ignorance was fantastic.
It still is, you know.
And we had to do a paper exercise of landing a force in the Persian Gulf and to strike up north to Tehran. And I can tell you, it was just incredible. Here was I, a little major, with these full colonels and brigadiers around me. And in our syndicate, to do the operation order, I sat on a table and I dictated the operation order to a full colonel, who was one of the best shorthand artists I ever came across. And he did all the typing.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the syndicate just listened, because they knew nothing about Iran, Iraq, or what the River Euphrates, whatever it was like. And as far as the landing, they didn't realize that you had to anchor your ship about half a mile offshore, and then you've got to bring everything in by lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Because the waters get so shallow that your ship can't get in alongside the dock, so everything has to be brought in by lighter.
Well, how did you know this?
From just normal education.
Mm-hmm.
And reading World War I of the campaign in Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, Allenby's in Palestine, but also having, through general knowledge of geography, know that you just acquire that kind of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But I was amazed. They had no idea. They had no idea of temperatures. Was it going to be hot? And I said, well, down in, you know, the Persian Gulf, you'll just steam. And by the time you get north of Tehran, you'll be so damn cold that you wish to God you had your fur coat on.
Yeah.
And they couldn't realize
action.
That.
Have many of them been in action themselves? Or were they
more? I had, in my syndicate, I had some jet jockeys. Or at least they weren't jets, they were ordinary fighter jockeys, as they call them. And they were naval flyers, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd seen some action.
But this,
and I had some submarine commanders who'd been in action.
Mm-hmm.
But and the army fellows had been in action in Europe, most of them, some of them in the Pacific. It was a good smattering, but they knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Unless Americans happened to be there. Their ignorance of world geography
But it comes from your education,
incredible.
I think, in Britain and in Canada. It's more of a cosmopolitan education.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to pick things up slightly better than the Americans. They're insulated,
I
think.
Completely insulated.
Yeah.
Our children went to school down in Virginia Beach, all of the grades 4 downwards,
mm-hmm.
and they were all top of their grades. And boy, did they ever get settled back to the right level when they got back to Ottawa later.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
The level of education is just horrible. In fact, many of the children down in Virginia Beach at that time didn't know what was north of the north of the 49th parallel, because every map they saw was cut off at the 49th parallel. There was a blank space above there.
And it wasn't America, so they didn't bother.
That's
themselves.
Right. It's
quite
extraordinary.
Was it a military school? Did the kids attend?
No, the ordinary school in Virginia Beach. But we had a lovely few months there, on September, October, November, December, January.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping for a posting out to the West Coast, back to beautiful BC, but I got shunted back into Ottawa again.
Did it? As what?
And this time, still no promotion. But this time I was put into DAQ.
Were you getting anxious about the promotion?
Oh, I was getting very anxious because I was being jumped. And unfortunately, they apparently had mislaid my documents. And they claimed that I'd had no regimental experience. And as an infantry officer, that held me back.
They'd done that to you once before, haven't they?
Well, this happened, actually cropped up when I was serving in Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And that the reason I was sent on the Armed Forces Staff College was to get me there, and then they would promote me.
Mm.
Well, the promotion did occur about 4 months after I arrived back, and I was put in charge of the Q Plan section in Ottawa.
And what was the Q Plan?
Well,
section?
Q Plans, I found out, was supposedly to develop the logistics plan in support of a Canadian armed force being sent somewhere or other.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that there'd be no plans because the Q Plans before me had been devoting themselves to riffling through the papers that came out of the tripart standardization from London and from Washington,
mm-hmm.
which I'd been involved in back in 48, 51. And I said, well, what about plans of a Canadian brigade being moved or a battalion being moved somewhere in the world? Do you know what equipment will be needed? How many trucks? What will be needed in the way of shipping in order to move it and so on? And my staff looked at me and said, what's wrong with this guy? That sounds like work.
Yes.
So anyway, I went across to the G branch, to their plans,
mm-hmm.
and said, what plans are you developing against a potential happening?
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at me blankly and said, oh, we've got other things to do. And I said, well, shouldn't somebody be doing something? And they admitted, they said they should. And I said, well, do you have anything at all? They said, look, you worked in G Branch for a long time, back when, and you develop your own. So I went back to my own little section, and I called them in, and I said, now we are going to develop what kinds of stores, vehicles, anything you can think of, medical stuff, everything that will need to accompany a battalion to an opposed or an unopposed landing somewhere. And we might as well do it for a brigade group at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Went down to Ordnance and said, can you tell me what equipment an infantry battalion should need? And they said, well, we've got these tables of equipment, and you pick out what you want. And I said, well, where's the old G-1098? World War II, we had a G-1098 that said exactly what an infantry battalion should have to go into an operation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, we've discarded that now. We have equipment tables.
Was it officially
and,
discarded, or was it just... Was it officially discarded, or...
Was officially discarded.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you mean I've got to go through all that to develop a G-1098? They said, don't use that term. We use equipment tables. And you go through the equipment tables and you pick out what you think is needed.
What you think is needed.
And I said, fine. So back I went to my staff with equipment tables, and we sat down, and we went through every blinking little piece of equipment, from an equipment strap to things, as, you know, what would be needed. And we worked pretty hard. And I told my director what I was doing. He said, well, that sounds good. And we worked up tables for an infantry battalion, and if we could multiply it by three for an infantry brigade. But then you had the artillery in support of the brigade, the engineers in support of the brigade, the medical in support of the brigade, and the signals in support of the brigade. All of these things had to be done too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, suddenly, a little thing called the Egypt taking over control of the Suez, NASA,
mm-hmm.
and the British landing there.
With the French.
With the French, and the kerfuffle, and finally Lester B. Pearson standing up and saying there should be a UN force, and it was agreed there should be a UN force. And it was decided in Canada that the Maggie, HMCS Magnificent
mm-hmm.
aircraft carrier, would be taking the troops, and be one battalion of infantry, and that they would go. And of course the Navy wanted to know how much equipment was going to be required, how many vehicles and so forth, and I had it all there. Sheer luck. And my director was as delighted as anything, because I was able to, within less than 48 hours, I was able to give the Navy a complete list of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, and apparently they felt they needed, the Chiefs of Staff felt they needed a liaison officer down in the United Nations, in 57, December of, I was selected to go down to be the liaison officer to the permanent delegation, or the Canadian permanent delegation to the United Nations. And indirectly, I was the military advisor to Mike Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
During the months of, I went down there for 3 weeks and I met and stayed there until March.
Okay, at this time he was what?
He was Minister for External Affairs.
Under Louis Saint-Laurent.
Right.
The election was still a little bit off.
Oh, yes. And I went down there and I was introduced to all the other military reps from the countries that are going to be involved in this UN force. And we were all taken up to the top floor of the Secretariat building, put into a big room with one big table around which all of us could sit, and with one telephone to be used by all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this and I said to myself, this is no setup. This is awful. They've just given us a place to sit, and we don't know what's going on, really and truly.
Was Pearson there as well at the time?
No. These were purely the military attachés.
What sort of powers were you given by the Canadian government?
No, I had no power.
So you were just sitting there and...
I was there to be a staff officer. And there was a military advisor to the Secretary General, and he was a dear little fellow. He was a Finnish general.
Mm-hmm.
And he had covered himself with fighting honors galore
in
the Finno-Russian War.
Yeah.
And he was just fantastic. He had a staff, one Italian officer, a major, one Pakistani officer, a major, and one Brazilian officer, a major. The Brazilian officer looked gorgeous in his uniform, but he couldn't read a map reference to save his life. He couldn't have put a pin into the proper place on a map to show you where something was. The Pakistani officer was a first-class staff officer. He'd been through the Pakistani Staff College,
mm-hmm.
and he was obviously Brit-trained, and he was good.
Yeah.
The Italian officer was a ladies' man completely. And staff work, that was the furthest thing from his mind. And here, the Finnish general, I found out he was away at one time. This was happened a little later on. But I found that he was stuffing all the telegrams that came from General Burns. He was stuffing them into his drawer. He had no filing system.
Mm-hmm.
The Pakistani officer felt that he really couldn't look into his desk drawers and, you know, find out what he'd hidden there. The Italian officer didn't give a hoot and hang. And the Brazilian officer was more concerned about how many things he could pick up while he was in New York City so that he could take them back to him take them back with him to Rio and sell at the dockside and then make some enough money to retire.
That left you, didn't it?
So I went through the general's desk and the stuff I found there. I set up a filing system for them. And with the help of the Pakistani officer, who was just a charming lad, we got the dear old general straightened out.
So you said General Burns, was this E.L.M. Burns?
Yeah, old laughing boy.
Old laughing boy.
Yeah. And anyway, when I first arrived there, we had this situation of all these military attaches. I was the only one who wasn't in a military attache. Mm-hmm. And they all had all come up from Washington. They wanted to get back to Washington. But I was going to be there. So I decided this huge room business wasn't good enough. So I wandered out into the outer room. And we're right on the very top floor, the floor on which the Secretary General has his office and everything. And I saw a room there with a number of typists and stenographers. So I wandered in, and I could see who was the Queen Bee. Mm-hmm. And I went over to her, and I said, "Do you by any chance have a nice little room up here that I could move into? I am so-and-so. I'm with the Canadian delegation. And I'm going to be here, I don't know how long, maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but I can't sit in there." Mm-hmm. And she was English originally. And she said, "Oh, yes, we've got a nice place here." So she showed me a very nice room with an outside window where I could look right across to the Empire State Building and the Woolworth Building and all the rest of the building. And I sat up there, put a map up on the wall, and put a few pins in. Mm-hmm. And I picked up the telephone and phoned Ottawa to the Secretary of the Chiefs of Staff and said, "Here's my number in the United Nations building. I'll be here, unless otherwise directed, every morning from 9 until 5. And I then started to look around, and I found on the desk a nice little box with a sort of dial phone thing on it. So I asked this lady, the Queen Bee, what this was. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, if there is something going on in the General Assembly, you dial that number. And then if you dial this, you can get it in English, or if you dial that, you can get it in French or any of the 5 UN languages." Mm-hmm. And I found out that I could sit there at my desk and I could listen into the General Assembly, or I could listen into any of the other committee rooms.
Including the one that you were stationed at on the top floor?
No. And I could do all that without moving from my desk. Mm-hmm. And if there was something really interesting on, well, I'd leave my office, leave a message, and I'd go down to the particular room and walk in, and, oh, I tell you, I had a time because I was right on the top floor. Mm-hmm. And I was there when King Ibn Saud arrived with his entourage and Lord his bodyguards equipped with knives and guns stuck in their belts. I was in the UN dining room when the party arrived there. Mm-hmm. And the guards stood around the table facing outwards while he was eating.
Did they test the food or taste the food?
I didn't notice that, but I noticed those of these guards. They picked hand-picked fellows. They were big. Mm. But they were all with knives in there. You couldn't believe it. And I remember Mike Pearson came to me one day shortly after I'd arrived and set up house there and said, "You've got a nice office." And he said, "Do you know who's around you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, Dr. Bunch is just 3 offices over from where I am." Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ralph Bunch is one of the world's nicest gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Terrific man. And he then, dear old Pearson, said, "Well," he said, "I've got a job for you." He said, "Does the Army still do appreciation?" I said, "Yes, sir." Well, he said, "I would like to have an appreciation done of and develop how many troops will be needed to be on a line from the Gaza Strip down to the Gulf of Aqaba." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Fine." And he said, "Don't bother about what nations will provide what troops." He said, "All I want is a total number." Or I said, "What is this force to do? Are they to stop people from crossing a mythical line?" Bearing in mind the country and the people who will move around there, nomads and so forth. Mm-hmm. Or are they to just be there and observe? He said, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, he said, I think just observe. I said, fine. One other question. When do you need to have this appreciation by? And he said, well, it's 4 o'clock right now in the afternoon. I'd like to have it by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. I had no secretary. I'd warned him I'd never been out to that part of the world. Mm-hmm. To which his reply was, well, you've read about Allenby's campaigns, haven't you? And I said, well, of course, sir. And he said, well, that's all you need. So I sat down and I started to write, just using my own general knowledge and from the staff experience that I had acquired during World War II and subsequent to that time. And I produced my appreciation, which came out of a figure of a number of troops. And I got it to his office by 9 o'clock the next morning.
Did you work on it all that night?
Oh, yes. Oh, I was a wide awake boy, I'm telling you.
How long was it for?
Because I had to type it up too, and I'm not a fast typer.
Two fingers,
with a bit of luck.
Yeah, how long was it, the appreciation?
Oh, golly. I think it was something in the order of about 25 foolscap pages.
A lot of work.
I cut down quite a lot. And I sent a copy of it off to the chiefs of staff, because I explained to Mike Pearson, this should be done by the chiefs of staff, not by me. I said, they've got the staff, they've got all the experts to call on and everything there. He said, Pope, he said, if I do that, he said, I'll never get it in time. So he said, I'm giving you an order now. He said, you will do it.
Did he have power to give you an order?
Oh, yes. Sure he did. Yeah. But I sent a copy to the chiefs of staff, to the secretary and the chiefs of staff, so they'd know what I'd said. And so help me, dear old Mike Pearson took my figure, just my total figure, didn't take my whole paper, but just the figure I came up with. I had all the background reasoning as to why this figure. Mm-hmm. And he took that down and he announced it in the General Assembly that afternoon. Mm-hmm. But unknown to me, before he came to see me to ask me to do this, he had sent a message out to Laughing Boy Burns for his staff to produce exactly the same. Now, they were on the ground.
Familiar with the...
They were there. Mm-hmm. They knew far more about the supply problems and so forth than I did sitting in New York.
And yet...
Working on general information. When they compared the two figures, they found he was asking for about 400 more men than I...